So we're working through this book of 2 Kings, and 2 Kings chapter 16 is our passage tonight. Last Sunday evening's passage, you may remember, covered 7 reigns, 5 reigns in Israel and 2 reigns in the kingdom of Judah. Tonight's passage, it only covers 1 reign, and that is the reign of King Ahaz in Judah. And I want to suggest then that the account of this reign of King Ahaz, it confronts us with 2 contrasting realities. And let's look at each of those then in turn. And first of all, the depths of human foolishness. That's the first reality. The depths of human foolishness. King Ahaz is a foolish man. One line in verse 2 puts that matter beyond doubt, even if nothing more were said about King Ahaz in the whole Bible, because we read there he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord his God. That tells us then straight away that this guy is a fool. But what the rest of the chapter does is explore a particular aspect of Ahaz's folly. The chapter requires careful probing. You have to delve a bit to get at certain things that are going on. But when you do that, you discover this: a foolish exchange. Ahaz makes a colossally foolish exchange. And this might sound a bit strange, but it's an exchange of fathers. It's an exchange of fathers. Notice verse 2 refers to his father David. Now, David, of course, isn't Ahaz's father in the immediate sense. Jotham is. Verse 1 says that Ahaz is separated from David by a lot of generations. But he is David's descendant. He belongs to David's line. So that verse 2's reference to his father David, especially for Hebrew readers who had a much stronger sense of genealogical connections than we often do, it's a meaningful and appropriate reference. David truly is Ahaz's father. And what a privilege then for this man Ahaz. You'd expect him to feel the weight of that privilege. I must be a faithful heir of this great father of mine. I must walk in his footsteps and truly be, in the way that I live and reign, David's son. That's what you'd expect. But of course, that's not what transpires. It's as if Ahaz looks at those noble footsteps in front of him, and instead of carefully placing his own feet in them, he turns around and walks in exactly the opposite direction. He rejects being David's son. But that's not all. It's worse than that. It's one thing to reject being David's son. It's another thing to reject being David's son and choose instead a different sonship. And that's what Ahaz does. Look at verse 7 and those words of Ahaz there. I am your servant and your son. To whom is he addressing those words? Well, he's addressing them to the king of Assyria, of all people. And against the backdrop of verse 2 then, Ahaz is effectively saying in verse 7, I'm not David's son, I'm Tiglath-Pileser's son. And that's what I mean then by this exchange of fathers. Let's probe this a bit further and explore what's happening in verses 10 to 18. There, Ahaz initiates some building work on the Jerusalem temple. Now, in and of itself, that is perfectly appropriate. Special building it might be, but the temple didn't magically maintain itself. Its human custodians had to see to its maintenance. And in particular then, Judah's kings were meant to be on the ball in that regard. Indeed, some of the best kings that Judah had carried out work on the temple. So I'm saying then that the mere fact of Ahaz doing stuff to the fabric of God's house, that is not in itself a problem. However, when kings of Judah did any work on the temple building, they were to do so within certain very fixed parameters. They were to be dictated by what had been set down by their father David. 1 Chronicles 28 is an important passage in this connection. There in 1 Chronicles 28, David is coming to the end of his life. He dies in the following chapter. And in various ways, at this point then, he's ensuring that Solomon is ready to succeed him. And that includes preparing Solomon to build the temple. And so we read in verse 11 of 1 Chronicles 28, "Then David gave Solomon his son the plan of the vestibule of the temple and of its houses, its treasuries, its upper rooms and its inner chambers, and of the room for the mercy seat, and the plan of all that he had in mind for the courts of the house of the Lord, all the surrounding chambers." And so it goes on and on and on. And then you come down to verse 19, where we have Solomon's own testimony, where Solomon says, "All this he," that is David, "my father, made clear to me in writing from the hand of the Lord, all the work to be done according to the plan." So you see then, the original son of David, Solomon, built the temple according to Father David's plan. And naturally, subsequent sons of David were to maintain the temple on precisely the same basis, being similarly dictated by Father David's plan. Now, is that how King Ahaz goes about his building project here in 2 Kings 16? No, it most definitely is not. Look first of all at verses 10 to 16. There, Ahaz goes to Damascus, and he sees in that city an altar. If you know your geography of the ancient world, you'll know that Damascus was Syria's capital. But verse 9 has told us something crucial. The king of Assyria marched up against Damascus and took it, carrying its people captive to Kir. So Damascus is now Assyrian. That's what verse 9 is telling us. Damascus is now Assyrian, so much so indeed that the king of Assyria seems to have taken up residence there. Damascus is now where you go, verse 10, to have an audience with him. And when therefore Ahaz sees a prominent altar in Damascus, the altar, verse 10 says, that was at Damascus, the main one, it seems, that will be a recently erected Assyrian altar. Certainly it will. Like any other conquering king in those days, the first thing Tiglath-Pileser would have done in Damascus is summon his craftsmen. "I want you to put up an altar here. These are the dimensions that I want it to have. These are the materials that I want it to have. This is the shape that I want it to have," and so on. Which means then that when in verse 10 Ahaz sends back to Jerusalem the pattern, that's the word used, the pattern for this altar, and commands his priest Uriah to get to work with that pattern, it's Tiglath-Pileser's pattern really. Because it's Tiglath-Pileser's altar that he's seen and is so impressed by. And it's Tiglath-Pileser's pattern, therefore, that has now been sent by Ahaz back to Uriah there in Jerusalem. Significantly, the Hebrew word translated pattern is the same one translated plan in that other passage, 1 Chronicles 28. So everything in the temple should be according to Father David's plan or pattern. That's what 1 Chronicles 28 is saying. Ahaz here is commissioning an altar for the temple according to Father Tiglath-Pileser's pattern or plan. An altar indeed that will overtly take precedence over the one dictated by Father David. It will be the great altar in the temple, verse 15. It will be the altar on which the daily offerings, the staple component, of course, of Israel's whole sacrificial system, will henceforth occur, verse 15 again. Like Solomon all those years earlier, Ahaz wants a temple that conforms to his father's wishes. Only in Ahaz's case, it's a different father we're talking about. A father whose name begins with T, not with D. Indeed, if it's evident in verses 10 to 16 with this business of the altar, it's no less evident when you move then into verses 17 and 18. There, Ahaz makes some rather odd alterations to the temple. King Ahaz cut off the frames of the stands and removed the basin from them, and he took down the sea from off the bronze oxen that were under it and put it on a stone pedestal, and the covered way for the Sabbath that had been built inside the house and the outer entrance for the king he caused to go round the house of the Lord. And you may not fully understand or be able to picture all of that, but all that really matters is six words at the end there, because of the king of Assyria. Not because of the king of Israel, David, and what he had set down, what he had stipulated in his temple plan all those years earlier. No, David is not the father that Ahaz listens to. Tiglath-Pileser is. So I'm saying then it's there throughout our passage this evening. This particular foolishness of King Ahaz, his exchange of fathers. And we must ask the question, what does he gain from this exchange? I mean, that's why you exchange things, isn't it? In order to gain. You don't exchange a newish, reliable car with a low mileage for an old, temperamental car with a high mileage, because that exchange is leaving you worse off. So what then does Ahaz gain from this exchange here? Presumably, Tiglath-Pileser must be a great guy, you might think. Caring and loving and the kind of man that anybody would want as their father. Well, no, actually. Do you remember how the prophet Isaiah has a famous encounter with this king of Judah, King Ahaz? It's recorded in Isaiah chapter 7. And this is what Isaiah says to King Ahaz, this king that we're looking at tonight. This is what Isaiah says to him, chapter 7, verse 17. The Lord will bring upon you and upon your people and upon your father's house such days as have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, the king of Assyria. In that day, the Lord will whistle for the fly that is at the end of the streams of Egypt and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. And they will all come and settle in the steep ravines and in the clefts of the rocks and on all the thorn bushes and on all the pastures. In that day, the Lord will shave with a razor that is hired beyond the river with the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the feet, and it will sweep away the beard also. Isaiah is saying, look, Ahaz, disaster is coming your way. You and your nation are going to be utterly humiliated. That's what being completely shaven of all hair meant in the ancient world for a man. It was an act of crushing humiliation, the fate of only the most unfortunate prisoners and slaves. You and your nation, Ahaz, are going to be utterly humiliated. And the agent of this impending disaster? The king of Assyria. That's what Isaiah says to Ahaz. In other words, going to the king of Assyria, as Ahaz does in verse 7 of our passage, going to the king of Assyria and saying, I am your servant and son, that wasn't going to elicit warm fatherly treatment from Tiglath-Pileser. He's a father who doesn't care tuppence for his sons. So Ahaz gains absolutely nothing from this exchange. The man he now claims as his father is cruel and nasty. All Ahaz will get out of the whole thing is disaster and humiliation and perhaps one other thing. Perhaps something of Tiglath-Pileser's cruelty and nastiness rubbing off on him. Tiglath-Pileser, I said, doesn't care tuppence for his sons. And neither in verse 3 does Ahaz care tuppence for his son. He even burned his son as an offering, the narrator says. That's perhaps Ahaz's other gain from all of this. He gains his new father's instincts and values and outlook, his new father's cruelty and sheer nastiness. What a deeply, deeply foolish exchange this is by Ahaz. This privileged son of David throwing that away and choosing instead to be a son of Tiglath-Pileser. Is there anything at all applicable to us then in all of this? Well, yes, there is. This possibility of exchanging something good and valuable for something worthless and destructive, that ought to serve as a warning to all of us this evening. Because we have something supremely good and valuable. We have the gospel of Jesus Christ, the gospel of full and free salvation through the incarnate, crucified and risen Son of God. We have that. And you know, people sometimes exchange that. People exchange that. People hear it and embrace it. They get baptized and become members of evangelical churches for years, possibly for decades. They live what seem to be full-orbed Christian lives. And then something happens. It might be through a toxic relationship that they get involved in. It might be through a difficult experience in a church where they're badly hurt. It might be through finding the cost of identifying as a Christian too high. It might be through being deprived of good teaching and or fellowship. It might be through a moral fall from which, for some reason, they never repentantly emerge. It might be through all kinds of things, but somehow or other, a drift away from Christ begins and then gathers momentum. And then eventually becomes terminal, and the gospel of Jesus Christ is exchanged for something else, for a different set of beliefs and for a different way of life, a different set of beliefs and a different way of life that won't reconcile them to their Maker and won't deal with their sin problem and won't keep them out of hell. I preached this morning that God has made a commitment to his Son to do for all his people what he's already done for him, for his Son. And that's a wonderfully assuring truth for those of us who are prone to doubt, and some of us are prone to doubt. And I love most of all preaching that kind of material. But the Bible contains warnings as well as assurances. And as well as those sensitive souls in the church who doubt, there are also going to be others who are growing cold, who may be slipping into a trajectory whose terrible endpoint is the exchange, this exchange that I'm talking about. And I wouldn't be a faithful preacher then if I didn't warn sometimes as well as assure. And the spectacle of Ahaz in 2 Kings 16, throwing away what was so good and valuable, it obliges me to warn just now. And so I say to you, don't ever, 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 ever foolishly, tragically, suicidally exchange Christ and his gospel for something else, which inevitably will be less, infinitely less. You remember how the book of Hebrews is driven, isn't it, by the fear that the original readers of that letter might be doing just that, exchanging Christ and his gospel for something infinitely less. And do you remember that very powerful line, which in some ways I think takes us to the heart of the whole treatise, the whole sermon, the whole epistle, that powerful line in chapter 12, verse 16 about Esau, who sold his birthright for a single meal. Such a disparity between what was lost by Esau and what was gained by Esau. If the stakes weren't so high, it would almost be comical, wouldn't it? His birthright, a single meal. The sheer disparity in that exchange, but it isn't comical. It isn't remotely comical. It's just awful. Take that line from Hebrews 12 with you throughout your Christian life. And if you're ever tempted by some alternative to your Christian discipleship, tell yourself in that moment, exhort yourself in that moment, plead with yourself in that moment. What is being offered here may look good, but all I will actually end up with is nothing more than a single meal and then everlasting damnation to follow. See to it, brothers. Hebrews 3:12 says, see to it, brothers, that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God. See to it. See to it tonight. See to it tomorrow morning and on Tuesday and on Wednesday and every day of your Christian lives until you're finally safely home and need see to it no more. See to it until then that you don't have a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God, that exchanges what is infinitely and inestimably precious for that which will damn you, which will crush you forevermore. I cannot emphasize too strongly how important this is. You know people, I know people, who once did on Sunday nights what we are doing this Sunday night. And they're not now. And they have no desire to now. And they're a million miles away from doing it now. Because they've exchanged what was infinitely precious for a single meal. And they're hurtling headlong towards the day when they will meet the God from whom their sinful, unbelieving hearts turned away. The depths of human foolishness. But then notice with me secondly and more briefly, the depths of divine faithfulness. The depths of divine faithfulness. So after everything that has preceded, that I've just been unpacking for you in this chapter, the last verse of the whole thing is really rather striking, where we read, Ahaz slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. Quite a stress there, isn't there, on something? And I think then that that verse is saying to us that while Ahaz, yes, can fail to be remotely recognizable as a son of David throughout most of his life, and he will face at a personal level the terrible eternal consequences of that lifestyle choice, he can't actually opt out of David's line and bring David's line crashing to a halt. He can't do that. Whether he liked it or not, whether he wanted to or he didn't want to, the fact is, at the end of the day, Ahaz, for all his willful rejection of Davidness, Ahaz, in fact, carried the line of David forward from King Jotham to King Hezekiah. And the line of David didn't collapse. And the line of David didn't fall into some black hole, never to emerge. The line of David continued through this king who rejected the line of David. How come? Well, because although Ahaz's foolishness may be deep, very deep, there's an even deeper reality at play here. And that deeper reality is God's faithfulness. And we talked last week about God's sheer determination to maintain David's line. That promise, remember, in 2 Samuel 7, through Nathan to David, your house will last forever. And God's subsequent determination to maintain David's line. And no Assyria besotted king then, like Ahaz, can derail or overturn that divine determination to maintain David's line. He might hate being part of David's line. He might not want anything more to do with David's line, but he's coming up against a divine promise. David's line will last forever. You're one link in that line. You, therefore, must fulfill your responsibility and carry the genealogy on. And there's a reason that God is so determined to maintain David's line. There are some words in this passage, I've already alluded to them briefly in passing, some words that make us feel sick, aren't there? Those words in verse 3, this is Ahaz, he even burned his son as an offering. This kind of thing comes up, as you'll know, a number of times in the Bible. Human sacrifice. They constitute some of the Bible's darkest moments. These moments always make us, as readers, feel sick. But there's one exception, isn't there? God has a son. And it has been his plan then from eternity to make him, his son, a sacrificial offering. And that is why he is so determined to maintain David's line, so that through that line, his son can become incarnate and be a sacrificial offering. And eventually it happens then. And God's son was born in the city of David, a human son of David. And 30 plus years later, on a Friday afternoon, he suffered an agonizing death, not ultimately at the hands of the Jewish leaders, not ultimately at the hands of the Roman judiciary, but ultimately at the hands of his own father. God did not spare his own son, Romans 8, 32. Yahweh put him to grief, Isaiah 53, verse 10. Ahaz-like, God one day watched his son writhe in the midst of the flames. Only in this case, the flames of hell itself. Why doesn't that one make us feel sick? Why do we go to 2 Kings 16, 3 and feel nauseated, and we go to Matthew 27 or John 19 and we sing, "When I survey the wondrous cross," and we see this son being sacrificed and the flames of hell descending on him, and we rejoice? Well, the answer is, of course, because in this case, in the case of God and his son, this is not a cold-hearted father catastrophically failing his son the way that Ahaz was catastrophically failing his. God is no Ahaz in that sense. He loves his son. It breaks his heart to plunge his son into Golgotha's lake of fire. But he and his son together have agreed that that price is worth paying in order to save a multitude of sinful human beings who otherwise, without this substitutionary sacrifice, would have to face the flames themselves. Ahaz's offering is the epitome of depravity. God's offering is the epitome of love. Here is love, vast as the ocean, loving kindness as the flood. And so as Ahaz then tries to plunge the line of David into disarray, "I'm no son of David," God won't let him. "Oh no, you don't, Ahaz. This line isn't going down the drain until it has provided my son with a human nature. Because like Abraham and Isaac, my son and I have an appointment on a mountain, a sacrificial appointment. And though that appointment, that sacrifice, will take us both into realms of pain and loss beyond anything we've ever experienced, we are going through with it. We are going through with it. And you, Ahaz, are not going to stop us. Christian, thank God this evening for the sheer, resolute, determined faithfulness that he showed in all kinds of circumstances throughout that Old Testament period prior to the birth of Christ, but not least at the time of Ahaz, when this stupid king tries to press the self-destruct button on the hope of the world, the line of David. And God wrenches his hand, Ahaz's hand, back off that button. No, you're not pressing that. This line's continuing. I have a son of mine who's going to be born into this line, so that I can do what you did and sacrifice my son, but I'm going to do it in love, Ahaz. Because I love a multitude of people and I'm going to save them. Praise God for his faithfulness, overriding Ahaz's foolishness and keeping everything on course for the cross of Calvary. Amen.